Some of you will be old enough to remember John F. Kennedy's book Profiles in Courage. It was a Pulitzer Prize-winning collection of short biographies describing acts of bravery and integrity by 8 United States senators. So you can see the political motive in publishing it. My next guest has written somewhat of a sequel to JFK's volume. It is titled The Peacemakers, Leadership Lessons from the 20th Century Statesman, and it offers portraits of 18 transformative leaders who advanced international peace, justice, freedom, and human rights throughout the 1900s. And in these complex times, it asks what the breakthrough thoughts of last century might teach us about the many intractable issues the world is facing today. As I told you at the outset, Bruce Gentleson is impressively credentialed. Suffice to say now that he's an expert in the field of leadership studies, and he boasts a hefty resume in the US Foreign Service. Bruce is currently a professor at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy and a global fellow at the Wilson Center. Bruce, welcome to LNL and congratulations on the book.
Thanks very much. It's good to be with you.
At a time, and I was making jokes about Trump's Nobel Peace Prize earlier, your book looks at what peacemakers from the 20th century can teach us. And you pose the question that must be posed: does history make statesmen, or do statesmen make history? And I must say that I agree with you. I think, although it's an unfashionable view, it's the latter.
Yeah, I think that's right. I try to come out in the middle ground there so that we don't get into too much, you know, hero worship. There can be constraints that any statesman, frankly, any leader in any part of society faces, and there can be conducive conditions. But the crucial thing is the choices they make. And I try to talk in the book about breakthroughs in which a different leader would not have either made the choices or been as successful in trying to see them through. Various types of breakthroughs, various types of leaders. And I was working on this before the latest round of elections in my own country and events in the world, because I thought it was really important, as you said, to think about when the chips are down and when things look like nothing can change, how things have changed, and get some strategy and inspiration from that.
The statesmen you choose range from a former Secretary of State and once a guest on this program, Henry Kissinger, to Guinness Brewery Secretary turned Irish peace activist Mairead Corrigan, to Microsoft's Bill Gates. How do you decide who made the cut?
Yeah, we had some criteria, and part of it was, would another person in that situation been able to do the same thing? But as you said, with the Northern Ireland example of Mairead Corrigan and her partner Betty Williams, you know, as we think about breakthroughs, sometimes they come top down, like from a Secretary of State or a Prime Minister, or the head of the United Nations. And a lot of times they come bottom up. In the Northern Ireland case, the Troubles, the killings between the Catholics and the Protestants had gone from less than 100 in 1969 all the way up to over 500. And it just so happened that the personal incident that Mairead Corrigan suffered with her sister and some of her nieces and nephews being killed happened at a moment where she made a statement, a very innocent statement on BBC, and we would call it today going viral. And it just set off a movement. It was a good example of person and moment. And it didn't solve the problem. It took another 20 years of diplomacy. But it was a real turning point in bringing the violence down and starting at least to head in the direction of peace. The Kissinger example is not in any way an endorsement of his whole foreign policy, far from it, but it looks at the U.S.-China breakthrough and the partnership between him and Zhou Enlai, which was really Kissinger at his best. And whatever the other issues between U.S. and China now in a half century, it's held up pretty well.
You say that there is no single recipe for good political leadership, but there must be traits common to many of the leaders you've studied.
There are, and I try to put those in the book in what I call sort of a who, why, how, what. There are some personal characteristics. You know, very few leaders are born leaders. Nelson Mandela is in the book. He's probably the closest to it, but probably the only one. Some of it is what I call the personal capital that they develop. Some of it's moral capital, like human rights leaders. Some of it's political standing. And combining that with political skills, because we've all known people who had a lot of, we thought had a lot of moral integrity and couldn't get things done. And so those two characteristics, you know, across the different levels, from the Northern Ireland women to the secretaries of state. The other piece is the vision, having a vision that gives people a sense of what's wrong with the present, where you want to take them, and a little bit how you're going to get there. Not, you know, deep philosophy necessarily, but something that, you know, can communicate to people and change is scary and give them a sense of that. And then building alliances. Nobody does this on their own. Having partners or foes you need to offset. And so that comes out differently with different types of issues. For major power rivalries, it sort of leads to one strategy. For human rights, another. But they all have this who, why, how, what framework.
While I find Kissinger's inclusion problematic, I was thrilled that one of my all-time heroes makes the cut, and that's Dag Hammarskjöld. Tell us, remind the listeners who may not be familiar with this extraordinary fellow, described by JFK as the greatest statesman of the century. Tell us what he achieved.
Yeah, he's really interesting. He was truly the most effective Secretary General the UN had. He was the second one. He came in 1953, and at the time he was dismissed as just another bureaucrat from those Scandinavian countries. There are three stories I tell in the book, but let me focus on the one that I think bears most today, which was the 1956 Suez Crisis. You had the invasion of Egypt by Britain, France, and Israel, because President Nasser had nationalized the Suez Canal. You had the Cold War competition with the United States and the Soviet Union having stakes. You had third world nationalism because of Nasser being seen as a leader of anti-colonialism. And you had the Arab-Israeli conflict. Nasser got in the middle of the diplomacy, and he managed to negotiate, really as the lead actor. It wasn't the U.S. and the Soviets. Within 10 days, the British, French, Israeli withdrawal. He formed with the Canadian foreign minister and ambassador Lester Pearson, really the first UN peacekeeping force and one that was enormously successful. Pearson actually won the Nobel Prize for that, and Hammarskjöld would win later. And they negotiated with Nasser to figure out how to bring in this peacekeeping force and how to solve the situation. I've been working on a piece now, you know, more of an op-ed to say, boy, what if we empowered the UN Secretary General Guterres to do the same thing in Syria right now?
Yeah,
clearly, the U.S. and Russia are coming close to a bigger conflict. The Syrian people are suffering. And it would really be in everybody's interest if we could have another sort of Hammarskjöldian Secretary General.
And, of course, he dies in rather mysterious circumstances.
Very mysterious. The investigation is being reopened again. He was trying to mediate the Belgian Congo independence. You know, and that same terrible witch's brew where you had different nationalists in the Congo, you had colonial interests, mining interests in Belgium and South Africa, Cold War competition. And it was a very mysterious death. There are various theories as to what might have happened, but it is being reinvestigated and in a sense in which there's a general sense it probably was not a simple airplane accident.
Bruce Gentleson is my guest. Another guest that on the program a few years ago was Gorbachev, and you rightly say that he's largely responsible for the end of the Cold War. Tell me your feelings about Gorby.
Yeah, you know, you hear a lot today that we're in a new Cold War. There's no question that U.S.-Russian relations today are very tense. There's all sorts of issues of President Trump and what his relationship is with Russia. But it's not a new Cold War. It's not global. It's not ideological. And we're not on the edge of nuclear confrontation like we all lived through during the real Cold War. And so what Gorbachev achieved, again, not by himself, Pope John Paul was a factor. Ronald Reagan contributed in his own way. But Gorbachev was the one who was essential to ending the Cold War peacefully, allowing Eastern Europe to go free. He could have invaded Poland like the Soviets had invaded before. It may not have succeeded, but another Soviet leader likely would have done that. And he had a vision for arms control. He even started talking about the environment and other sorts of issues. What he failed to do, because I talk in the book about learning from leaders' successes and failures, was consolidate his political base. There's an expression sort of from people that write about leadership about keeping the opposition close and lowering the temperature. And he didn't do that. And so we now live in a world where he is a hero to many of us in the West and other parts of the world. And he is, you know, held in very low regard in his own country. And so that was his failing that prevented him from further consolidating his changes. But it by no means offset what he achieved. It's just you want to draw lessons from both where they had strengths and where they had shortcomings.
Last week I talked to former Assistant Secretary of State Daniel Freed, and he was pessimistic about the current state of U.S.-Russian relations. I'm not for a moment arguing against your simple and overwhelmingly accurate statement that this Cold War ain't like the last Cold War, but are you pessimistic about U.S.-Russian relations now?
I am pessimistic, and it has a lot to do with who our leaders are, including President of the United States. At the end of each part of a section of the book, I say, what are the lessons? And I do have a section there saying, what would be the lessons for Trump and Putin? What would be the lessons for Trump and Xi Jinping? And I say, I'm not predicting here, but I am making a case as to how you could get on a better path. I think the Russians have reached the point of diminishing returns as one example for what they're doing in Syria. They're about to be responsible for another Afghanistan for them if they stay much longer. I think the United States doesn't have a policy. It decides to, you know, send missiles at this chemical weapon strike and not that one. The Syrian people continue to suffer. Israel and Iran move closer to a confrontation. So I really think there is a U.S.-Russian interest in trying to manage this situation, including what I was saying before about bringing in the U.N. Secretary General. I can see a path that's not naive or idealistic, that's very pragmatic. I'm just not that optimistic that our current leader, perhaps even more than Putin, that he could figure that out.
LNL on RN, on your digital radio and online, and we're talking to Duke University's Professor Bruce Gentleson, a global fellow at the Wilson Center and author of The Peacemakers, Leadership Lessons from 20th Century Statesmen. Bruce, you've spent a lot of your life contributing to the U.S. Middle East policies, and I've just read your very poignant account of the night you heard of Yitzhak Rabin's death.
Yeah, that was the one that was probably most personal, because I was serving, you know, on a leave from being a professor in the State Department in 1993-94 when Bill Clinton was president, and the first breakthroughs happened, and I had worked then and have continued to work both in government and from the outside in the Middle East. And it was staggering news. It's a classic example of how crucial an individual is. Shimon Peres succeeded him, ran for election on Rabin's legacy, but wasn't Rabin. He wasn't the soldier, his peacemaker. He was a wonderful man in many ways. People said he was the poet of peace, and Rabin wrote the prose. And so the elimination of Rabin fundamentally changed things. I talk in the book, and I interviewed Rabin's daughter and asked her, did she believe that the process would have succeeded if he had not been killed? And, you know, she really thought about it and said that, you know, she couldn't be sure, and her father was getting frustrated with Yasser Arafat, but he felt that they had been able to work things through and they could continue to work them through. And in the end, Rabin was assassinated by a countryman. Not by a Palestinian or anybody else. And, you know, if you look at the situation today, what's going on at the Gaza fence and so many other ways, it's just hard to argue against the notion that Israel, the Palestinians, the region, and the rest of us would have been much better off if that process had succeeded and Rabin had been able to bring it to fruition.
Bruce, I can see in my mind's eye that uneasy handshake with Yasser Arafat. you know, Rabin doesn't want to shake his hand, but knows he must. It's a very poignant moment in the annals of modern history.
Yeah, and that was a classic Bill Clinton moment, you know, where his charm, and he had great respect for Rabin, the elder statesman. He learned a lot from him. But he basically said, you really got to do this. And I think Rabin's line was fine, but he can't be wearing his holster and his gun, Arafat, when we're up there in the White House lawn. And they, you know, they continued to meet. There's a story I tell in the book that Arafat was not allowed to go to Rabin's funeral for both political and security reasons. But he paid a shiva call, you know, the way, you know, in the Jewish religion, you know, you, in terms of the mourning period, on Mrs. Rabin quietly to show his respects. And, you know, in some respects, Arafat has a lot of responsibility for the failure of the peace process after that. I think Rabin had a way of helping Arafat, you know, balance his own sense of things and see what was really in the interest of the Palestinian people. And we can't know for sure, it's counterfactual history, but I feel like you can make a strong argument that, you know, there was a high percentage chance that that would have succeeded, and it surely would be better than what's happened for the last 20 plus years.
Bruce, as I turn the pages of The Peacemakers, I keep coming across people who've been on the program. One of them is Aung San Suu Kyi, and she's one of the leaders you talk about who are great in one area but bitterly disappointing in others.
Yeah, we titled that chapter A Cautionary Tale, and I had been writing it based upon, you know, her role from, say, 1988 to 2015 and the amazing moral capital she had and personal courage and ability to mobilize her people like no other leader could have. And then as we were finishing up the book last summer and fall, we have the Rohingya really genocide and ways in which she is at minimum complicit in it. It's being conducted by the military. Her powers are there, but they're somewhat tenuous. But she hasn't made any significant effort to stop it. And we talked about should she be in a book called The Peacekeepers. And I've got to give my editor credit because I was beginning to get a little morose about this. And he said, our whole goal in this book is to show exactly what you just said, what the strengths are, what the shortcomings in the same person, you know, why their leadership skills work for one set of issues and not another. And if we tell the story right, and I'm sure there'll be people that say, I'm sorry, she shouldn't be in the book, period. But that's what we tried to do. So on a smaller scale, Lech Walesa's in the book, and he was a terrible president of Poland.
Another guest on the program, another guest.
There you go. But an amazing leader of the Polish Revolution. And so both are true is kind of the conclusion we hope people draw.
Well, look, you also say that we're witnessing a shift in the geography of statesmanship. Please explain.
Yeah, in fact, I was in Australia in 2013 as a visiting scholar at ANU, at Australian National University, when I was first thinking about this book, and I gave some talks on it. And there and elsewhere, the comments were that it was very Western, the list, and very male. And I thought a lot about that. And I mean, there are some, you know, Southern, quote unquote, third world leaders in there. But my sense was, and I talk about this in the book, that was the nature of 20th century international relations and the major breakthroughs that affected global peace and security by the structure of the system. In the 21st century, we've begun to see, and I think we'll continue to see, the emergence of more women leaders playing large roles in international affairs and more leaders from the South. You know, there'll never be another Mandela, or unlikely per se, but there will be leaders like him that speak to their country's issues as well as the broader global agenda. And I think there's a lot of, I mean, even the United States, you know, we've had three female secretaries of state since 1997, and we had none before. We obviously do not yet have a female president. So I think that those trends are there. And if one were to write a book about this, like this 50 years from now, I think it would be easily more women and more people from the developing world who would be included.
Will the the institutions that can make peace possible survive in your country, survive the Trump presidency?
Very hard to say. I I'm obviously someone who's worked for Democratic. I worked for President Obama in his State Department, President Clinton. I actually chaired one of the foreign policy advisory groups for Hillary Clinton's campaign.
You worked for Al Gore.
And I worked for Al Gore for many years when he was a senator and a presidential candidate. I am disturbed beyond just this or that policy. I think that the way this president goes about foreign policy, he's becoming, you know, the great disruptor. You know, no climate change agreement, lots of protectionism, no NAFTA. We'll see what happens in Korea, but for a while we were all afraid we were on the edge of war. In the Middle East, no two-state solution.
Bruce, on that happy, even euphoric note, we must take our leave. Thank you very much for your time. The voice of Bruce Gentleson, distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center and author of The Peacemakers, Leadership Lessons from the 20th Century Statesman, published through W.W. Norton. Coming up tomorrow, the future of the Iranian nuclear deal, talking about diplomacy and Trump, and Richard Lloyd Parry talking about the tsunami that struck Japan in 2011. Thanks for listening. Back with you tomorrow.